Okay, go ahead.
Hey, welcome, welcome, welcome. We have now another edition. This is Peter Pearson again, welcoming you to our talk today, which is, I think it's terrific. It's on integrity, which is one of the most cornerstones, I think, of a couple relationship. If you're going to create and realize so much of the potential in your relationship, I think the foundational block has to do with integrity, which generates trust, transparency, taking risks, being open, and going together as a team. And the foundation of that is integrity. And I am so glad that we have our guest speaker today, Dr. Jim Hutt, a colleague and friend of mine, who also has his office in Menlo Park, California. Jim has a PhD in clinical psychology. He's licensed as a marriage family therapist. He works primarily with couples. And here's what's interesting. He really enjoys working with high conflict couples, high distress couples. He does a lot of parenting coaching, which may also be an offshoot that he has two kids in college. So he's been in the trenches. He knows what it's like. And coaching parents on how to raise responsible kids, support them in their endeavors, their interests, their values, is such a valuable thing. He also works with individuals, and he counsels divorcing couples, substance abuse, and he is developing, actually, which I'm looking forward to seeing myself, a series of videos for couples on how to manage conflict. And that's coming out in December, January. So in talking about integrity, though, I really, really am glad that Jim is the one who's doing the presentation today on integrity, because that's the way he lives his life. So, Jim, welcome. I'm really glad that you are here today and talking about what I think is such a key concept of relationships that are going to flourish. So, welcome, Jim.
Thank you, Pete. It's wonderful to be here. I sincerely appreciate the opportunity to be associated with the Couples Institute in general, and in particular with you and Ellen, Pete. It's really, really nice. And I consider it an honor to be given this stage today, and I'm looking forward to it. I like to talk about integrity, and I agree with you. It is a crucial core of what I call thriving relationships, and integrity is a little bit, I think it's often misunderstood and not understood with all of its breadth and depth, and so today what I want to talk about, what I'm going to cover in this talk is obviously defining integrity and giving folks an idea on how to think about integrity in a little bit broader view than we might be used to. I'm also going to talk about and focus on where and how we learn our first lessons about integrity, because actually, if we really want to get picky about it and interesting about it, it really does go back to our youngest days on the planet when we're infants. And following that, I want to also look at the impact of parental influences on the formation of integrity as we go through our development, and then how relationships later on reinforce our degree of integrity, and then how integrity is left out of courtship and the impact of that on the eventual marriage and or committed relationships. Now, when I talk about marriage today, I'm also going to be talking about committed relationships. They are one and the same thing to me. I understand that there are many people who may be listening who are in committed relationships but who have not been legally married, and I am making no moral case or judgment for or against that. I see many people who are married legally who are very divorced otherwise, and many people who are in committed relationships who never got married who have wonderful relationships. So I just want to say that up front.
Oh,
and
cool.
There'll be a few other things along the way that I'll look at, but that's going to be the thrust of what I talk about today.
Hey, just out of curiosity, because integrity is such an important topic, what sparked or triggered your interest in placing the concept of integrity in such a high importance?
Well, you know, I was afraid you were going to ask me that. because I got to looking at my own integrity in my own marriage, which will be 30 years next month, and realized that it's extremely easy to sell oneself out, not live with integrity, and have to deal with the conflict that comes about as a result of that. So you really end up with conflict on top of conflict. So really, it was from my own personal experience in my own marriage that led me to thinking a lot about it. And, of course, you know, sitting with, you know, I don't know how many hundreds of hours of couples every year. But that's basically it, to have one spouse call you on your own integrity and say, wait a minute, what are you talking about? And I go, ooh, I am so busted.
That's a big oops. When our spouses say, you know, you might not be quite in alignment with your higher self and practicing what you preach. At least, you know, sometimes Ellen will hold that mirror up to me.
Yeah, to which I respond with, moi? Yeah. So, yeah, personal experience. No teacher like personal experience, for sure.
So that was your own just personal kind of being confronted with not being in alignment with your higher self was one of the catalysts for you to start learning and practicing or creating more of an emphasis on this?
Yeah, and I'll tell you, too, one other piece of that. In my practice, you know, it's not uncommon for therapists to make mistakes, sometimes big ones, most of the time hopefully little ones. But every now and then I'll make a mistake and I'll be called on it, and I found that people want to hear you tell the truth. They simply want you to validate their reality when they say, hey, Hutt, did you fill in the blank with whatever? And you go, oh, my gosh, you're right, I did. They're relieved. And so there's a phenomenological experience that occurs in crucial settings, whether it's in the therapy room or in the living room with one's partner, where when that happens, you suddenly create a very another brick in the road of safety, and therefore trust, and therefore, you know, you name it, it's a cascading effect. And so, yeah, that it, you know, it's not only being called on something when you haven't lived up to your higher self, but it's also when you've decided to live up to it, and it gets recognized, and you see the fruits of it. It's very, very powerful.
Wow, that's right on. It's being real, and there's something about being real that's very compelling to the other person.
Absolutely. So what I want to talk about to begin with is just exactly, you know, let's be kind of get down to basics here about what integrity is. And I think that one of the surface and most common understandings of integrity is that it's making the decision to be honest in any interaction that challenges one to be dishonest. Now, in effect, every time we have the opportunity to be honest, by definition, we have the opportunity to be dishonest. And but that's a very cursory way of looking at it. I think that making the decision to be honest in any interaction challenges one to be dishonest. And there's a whole variety of reasons for that. But I like to look at the word integrity and kind of stretch it a little bit and think of the word integration. And so one of the ways that I've come to understand integrity as an experience versus as a concept is that it's behavior that's consistent with the integration of our values, our history, our senses, and our beliefs. And, you know, if you begin to look at integrity that way, there's a lot more to it than meets the eye. Now, what this culminates in, I've kind of taken on this pet term called IQ, intelligence, or integrity quotient, not intelligence quotient, but IQ meaning integrity quotient, so that all of us at some point in our lives, if there were to be a numerical way of doing this, would have, if it were measurable, we would all leave home with a particular ability to live or manifest our personal integrity. That's on one side. On the other side of the coin, we also have the ability to tolerate the degree to which our partners or significant others in our lives manifest their integrity. So two people arrive at a relationship with each of their IQs. Let's call it 100%, and I don't know if anybody's at 100%. I know I'm certainly not, but we all are trying to achieve that as our goal. We're trying to live to, the, you know, aspire to the people we want to be at 100%. Most of us fall short of that, and that's the IQ, the integrity quotient we show up in a relationship with. All right? Now, what that means, though, is that the degree to which somebody's IQ or two people's IQ exist in relationship, the couple has an IQ as well. And that IQ is only as high as the individual with the lower IQ. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense, what you're talking about. And when you talk about IQ, you know, one of the newest variations of looking at IQ is that we have different forms of intelligence. I'm wondering, do you think that some people have, in some areas of their life, they have more integrity than in other areas or topics in their life or situations?
Yeah, I think they do. I think that's absolutely right, which makes it difficult on one hand because one can see oneself as having a particularly high degree of integrity in some things, but not in other things. I'll give you an example of that. My father was an interesting guy. Now, he died of a heart attack at the age of 56, and quite a young guy. And one of the things that he prided himself in was his high integrity. And I remember him talking about that. He happened to also have worked for the Internal Revenue Service, which I don't admit to many people, but he was that's a business where you really ought to have high integrity. But the interesting thing was his integrity about how he dealt with his emotions and how he dealt with conflict at home was actually quite different. As I look back in retrospect, I can see that on the one hand, well, he could hold himself up to a particularly high standard of honesty about particular facts, about money, about taxes, about all that kind of stuff with his job. That was not in alignment necessarily with how he dealt with things at home. Now, this was a good guy, but he came from an era when men didn't talk about their feelings, which is not all that different from now. If they did have feelings, they didn't express them. And so how he and my mother managed conflict, when I look back, I can clearly see there were two different integrity quotients, if you will, within the larger quotient that he manifested. That answer your question, Pete?
Oh, yeah. It's really amazing how we can feel virtuous about ourselves because in a key area of our life, we feel like, in fact, we do have a lot of integrity. And then in another area of our life, the standard shifts, the yardstick shifts.
That's right. It does. And it's difficult to see. And that's why when I look at integrity as being the integration of those things, it's being able to see, well, where, you know, stand back, reflect, take a look at myself, take a look at my behavior, what are the different venues in which I operate, and where or how much does my integrity vacillate in those areas. And my guess, too, is that integrity also is dynamic in the sense that it might be low one day in the area where I typically have it low, but it might be higher the next day in that area where I typically have it low. So
that's interesting, yeah.
You know, it just depends.
The needle moves, you know,
yep.
Probably according to a lot of different factors.
The needle moves according to a lot of different factors, and so integrity is not an easy thing to think about. That's why I encourage parents when they're working with their kids and they're so upset about their kids lying to them. I love asking a set of parents, did you ever lie to your kid? And you ought to hear the stony silence I get before they answer. So let's see. Let me focus a little bit on some of the main systems that provide us our first lessons in integrity. And obviously the family of origin is one. We're going to see how our parents deal with one another. We're going to see how they deal with us. Another one are the institutions that we grow up in. And, of course, the family is one institution. Schools are another institution. And we'll cover more of those in a minute. Another one where we get lessons about integrity are our social interactions with our friends, with family, friends, other parts of our family, our cousins, our brothers, our sisters. Boyfriends, girlfriends, all those social interactions provide us all kinds of lessons in integrity. And, of course, the culture at large has some pretty standard lessons in integrity that we pick up on. Some are gender-specific and some are not. Now, what's the purpose of looking at these systems? Well, there's a couple of reasons. One is, if you look at all the different systems I just mentioned, you can ask yourself what messages you may have taken away from each system along the way, when you're in grade school, middle school, high school, college, courtship, et cetera, college, graduate school. You know, there are messages that we take away about integrity from all of these places. And the other thing is that if we can understand those messages, our children are also getting the messages from those institutions as well. So it'd be interesting to see what's the difference between what we grew up with and our awareness of it and what our kids are growing up with and how we connect with our kids about integrity, given that they have to cycle through most of those same institutions that we cycled through when we were growing up.
Oh, no kidding. You know, but when you talk about institutions like politics, I think in some sense the voting public trains politicians to lie. Because if politicians really tell the truth about what needs to be done, they don't get elected. So politicians go, they make all kinds of promises about what they will do when they're elected. And then when they get in, they can't deliver. And I think what happens is it just increases the amount of cynicism in our political institutions, for example. But I think partly is the responsibility of the voters by training politicians to lie in order to get elected.
Yeah, it's true. And then we wonder why people don't want to vote.
Exactly.
After a while. So there's a very, very strong influence by the political system, by politicians, by parties, you know, the whole nine yards. It's extremely powerful. But let me say a few words about the family of origin and the development of integrity. First of all, one of the first things that happens to us is that when we're infants, we're fed. We're given the bottle or we're given the breast. And it's interesting. I remember talking to my kid's pediatrician, and pediatrician said, okay, look, here's the thing I want you to know. He's a very, very interesting, very smart guy. And he said, you know, ideally what you do is, you know, you can have equal time on each breast so that you don't get sore. And my wife said, well, what if the kid doesn't, you know, want to comply? And he said, well, that's a very important question. He said, you really want to follow the kid's lead, because if the kid turns away after having been on the breast for 7 minutes or 10 minutes, the kid might be saying, I'm not hungry anymore. And you probably ought to let the kid know that he or she is the better judgment of how hungry they are, instead of sticking their head back on the breast and saying, no, you're not. You haven't had your 15 minutes. Get back there. And I thought that was I never forgot that. What he said was,
wow.
Trust your kid to know himself or herself at the breast. That's a pretty powerful statement, I think.
At an extraordinarily early age.
At a very early age. We're talking, you know, days.
Yeah.
Days old.
Right. Infants. Wow.
Infants. So then as children, you know, develop and go through their young lives, there's all kinds of ways in which we have the opportunity to validate small childhood realities. They may seem insignificant to us, but if we're aware of some realities, the kids seem huge. If we validate those, we teach the kids that, number one, they told us something, we listened to what they said, we acknowledged it. If it called for empathy and compassion, we gave some. If it didn't, we didn't. We gave something else. But the point is that the kid learns what I have to say is important. So that's good. I'm going to keep on speaking my mind. And that the way that there are so many ways in which we invalidate small childhood realities, that it teaches kids that integrity is a very slippery thing. And among them, of course, are emotional inconsistencies. It's extremely common for kids when they notice distress on part of the parent. A 3-, 4-, 5-, 6-year-old, 9-year-old will come up to a parent and say, Daddy, Mommy, are you okay? And what's the usual answer? I'm fine. No problem over here. When the truth is, yeah, I'm kind of upset right now. Things aren't going so well at fill in the blank with wherever. But I'm going to be okay.
What's interesting about what you're saying, Jim, is when the parent says, no, I'm fine, the kid has to question their own reality.
That's
because
correct.
The kid will say, my reality says, no, something is wrong here. And the parents, out of, I guess, a good intention, not wanting to worry the kids, will deny that there's a problem. And out of wanting to spare the kids some potential stress or worry, they will, in a sense, lie to the kid.
Exactly.
And so the kid starts to question at an early age, what I see as I go through life, is it real or isn't it real? And they question. They end up not having a very solid foundation. But I think if the parent would say, well, you know, actually, you're right. You're picking up on something that I'm struggling with the problem. I'm working on it. Hasn't been solved yet, depending on the age of the kid. Hasn't been solved yet. But I'm working at trying to find a solution, and that's what you're noticing. The kid often, if they're young, they don't need any more information than that, but their reality has been validated.
Well, exactly. And see, one of the things that kids are asking, particularly if they're pre-latency age kids, and even after that, but for sure...
What age is pre-latency?
Pre-latency, I would say, is any time before the ages of 7 to 9.
Okay.
All right. All they're wanting to know when they ask the question is, am I okay? Meaning the kid.
Yeah.
They're so tied into us that if we're okay, they're okay. And that whole issue of differentiation, which we'll talk about a little later on, plays into it. But the thing is, if my kid says to me, Daddy, are you okay, and I'm not, and I say, yes, I am, I've also, in a very direct way, taught my kid how to lie.
Yeah.
And I haven't even thought twice about it. So outright commissive lies... the telling of lies, kids pick up on. They're very, very sensitive. They're really these incredible little devices that can pick up on everything. They hear everything, they see everything. Problem is they don't know what to make of it. That's why they ask.
Right.
So we need to really allow ourselves to take what feels like a risk to say, no, I'm not okay.
Right.
But I'm working on it, and it's going to be fine. You're no problem. There's no problem here for you. They love that. And, of course, then there's the omissive lie piece that we do with kids. When we don't tell them things that they might be better off hearing, that they'll either find out from other people or they'll find out later on in life, or they'll find out that there's also an omissive lie that's committed with commissive lies when it comes to emotional inconsistencies that we tell our kids. If they come to us and say, no, if they ask if we're okay and we're not, and we say, oh, no, I'm fine. You know, we've omitted telling them the truth, but we've actively not told them the truth at the same time. It's kind of a double whammy.
Wow.
The other thing we do is that we can set up a situation where the lies that we do tell, either that they tell as kids are rewarded or the lies that we tell them are rewarded. All of those things figure into integrity. And so it's important. And now what I'm really talking about is there are times when we know as parents when our kids are not being truthful, but we don't know what to do about it. Or what we do about it, we reward in a negative way or a positive way. We really don't deal with it consequentially to help teach the kid that lying is really not a good thing and show them how it's not by other than punishing them or getting angry at them. So
what do you
really
mean by rewarded? What do you mean by rewarded?
Well, by rewarded, I mean if my kid lies to me about something, and I find out, and I go to that kid and I say, you lied to me, you're grounded for a week. That's a reward. The kid has said, okay, I can pay that price. If I lie again, I can pay that price. That's not so bad. Being grounded, yeah, I can deal with that. If I go to my kid who's lied to me and say, hey, you lied to me about that, didn't you? I want to talk about it. Well, the first thing they have to do is talk about it. They don't like that. That's painful.
That's even worse. Oh, God.
And then we tell them, you know, when you lie to me, it's hard to trust you. So I don't know what I'm going to do about that, but I'll let you know. Don't worry about it. In the meantime, don't worry about it. And then the next time they want to do something, if you say, you know, yeah, I'd love to let you go out tonight, but boy, I only let kids go out who I trust. I think you're going to have to stay in tonight. Then they begin to learn that lies are not going to be rewarded.
Oh.
You can't buy off on a lie because the lie goes to trust, and trust goes to integrity. And if you don't have integrity, then things are going to come to a grinding halt. And that's what's important, in my opinion.
Oh.
See, I think the other thing that reinforces lying is parental reactivity. if the parents fly off the handle because a kid got, you know, did something wrong, made a mistake, forget about lying for a minute, just a mistake. There are things that kids can do that parents will respond to with high reactivity, and the kid learns, oh, my gosh, I guess it's not okay to make a mistake, number one. And number two, I'm not sure what to learn from it because all I heard was mom or dad's yelling and put-downs. I'm not sure where to go from here. I'm confused. And then they go and say, I'm confused, Dad, Mom, what do I do with this? And Mom and Dad doesn't have any idea. They just don't want you to do it again. So a lot of that stuff has a huge role. Parental reactivity has a huge role in helping kids develop their reactivity or their integrity or not.
Well, so unwittingly, people can train each other to be dishonest in terms of lying.
Oh, absolutely. You bet. Because
yeah,
one of the things that happens if people get reactive, you and I know what happens to the limbic brain, right? It's on alert, and all it wants is relief. And so one of the ways I'm going to get relief is to lie or to withdraw and do something that's not going to work. The other thing about parental reactivity, not only toward the kid, but kids watch parental reactivity toward each other. So if mom and dad are reactivity toward one another, what do you think a kid learns about being in conflict later on in life with a significant other? Don't do it.
So then you end up with a really high conflict avoidant person who really doesn't want to deal with conflict. They don't have the emotional resiliency, and so their partner sometimes will say, what's wrong? Nothing. Because they don't want to go down that path. Risk creating a conflict.
Exactly. And so what that means is that conflict-averse behavior always puts a ding on integrity. There's no way to have integrity and be conflict-averse simultaneously. Now, I'm not being absolute about it. It's not like there's no integrity, but it's going to take a hit, and that's what's important about that. All right? A word about institutions, schools, churches, governments, sports, workplace. Those places also, you know, they're made up of people, and everywhere we go, because there's people there, then we have the chance for conflict. And there are ways in which we see people deal with all these institutions that have an impact on developing integrity. Now, social interactions has to do with friends, teachers, boyfriends, girlfriends. The cultural influence on integrity by gender is interesting. First of all, for men, we're taught not to feel, and we're told if we do feel, not to express it. If we're women, there are many examples, but one of the more formidable ones that we're taught, for example, is that sex is dirty, but women are taught to be sexually attractive. So there's an interesting way in which integrity gets woven into that one.
It goes back to you cannot integrate those two diverse messages. Integrate them.
Yeah, because they're at odds with each other.
Yeah.
You're not supposed to be sexual because it's dirty, but you're supposed to look good for men who get to act out how dirty sex is. Isn't that interesting? That's a whole other book in and of itself, but it's fascinating how its impact on integrity. Now, those institutions that I mentioned, every one of those exists within a hierarchy, and every venue in which we exist prior to marriage or a committed relationship is a hierarchical one. And, of course, the only venue that's not hierarchical is supposed to be the one of marriage, but ironically, venues of hierarchy leave us really ill-prepared for non-hierarchical relationships like a marriage or a committed relationship. Now, one of the byproducts of hierarchy is that if the hierarchies that we grow up in largely reinforce conflict aversion, then by definition integrity is compromised. And it's pretty hard if you're a young kid in first grade or second grade to buck the hierarchy of the school. So you're going to do stuff to stay out of trouble if you get into trouble. Unless, of course, you've been raised by parents who say, look, if you get in trouble, own up to it. It's worse not to than if you do. But that isn't necessarily where all of us come from. The other byproduct of hierarchy is that hierarchies tend to rely on and reinforce what I refer to as positional power. In other words, the position in a hierarchy is more important than the person often is, and that's an important difference. So when hierarchy does not access and reinforce personal power, it reinforces overpowering behavior. And powerful behavior then becomes confused with overpowering behavior. And I think it's really, really important that, somehow that gets looked at. Let me see. What was the other thing I wanted to say about that? oh, yeah, positional versus personal power. Now, because the different hierarchies we exist in, and obviously the family being hierarchical as well, positional power tends to produce overpowering behavior. What that means is I can get you to do what I want you to do because I have position over you. And if I'm your parent, for example, and I say, we're moving, we're leaving town, we're going to move, it doesn't really matter how I feel about it. Now, in a hierarchy, and I'm going to be partially revealing here about some of my own past because this is a good example of it. I remember we moved many, many, many times, which led to me making the decision, I'm not going to make my kids move, and in fact, we never have moved because of that. But one of the things that would have made it nice in my family hierarchy is if my father would have come home and said, well, guys, looks like we have to move again because I'm up for the next promotion with the government. How do you feel about it?
Oh, just asking.
Just asking how do you feel about it says what you feel matters, even if what you do can't be considered.
Oh,
because,
wow.
You see, that did not happen. And I think that that makes a big difference to a kid, because a kid, that says to a kid, speak. I want to know what you're thinking. I want to know what you're feeling, and I want to know what you're going to do. And see, the positional power that people have tends not to go for and reinforce personal power. Then that's what hierarchies tend to do. So positional power tends to produce overpowering behavior. I experienced those moves as very overpowering because I had no voice. Personal power, on the other hand, tends to produce powerful behavior. All right? It'd be very powerful had my father said, hey, Jim, hey, Rick, hey, my other five brothers and sisters, what do you all think about us moving? We would have had a pretty damn lively discussion, and we would have felt pretty
wow.
good, you see. But that
wow.
didn't happen. That would have been powerful if he would have asked that question. Now, let's talk a little bit about overpowering behavior and its connection to integrity. First of all,
hey, Jim, I just want to reinforce what you said.
Yep.
Because I'm working with the couple, and in fact, he is moving from California to the East Coast. And they did say to their kids, well, we have this opportunity. How do you feel about moving? Now, he is going to take the job. However, the couple did exactly what you're talking about, which is they got input from the kids, and it made all the difference in the world. And it's just to support what you're talking about, which is asking how they feel, even though they don't get the final vote in it, but somehow acknowledging the legitimacy, the importance of what the kids feel makes the transition so much better. It just totally supports what you're saying, because the kids are now, they've adapted to it, and they're looking forward to it.
Yeah, that's right. They don't have a decision maybe about whether or not they're going to go. But I'll bet you that with those parents, they sound like they're really, really wise people. They're giving the kids an input into how it's going to go. What's it going to be like? And that is a very powerful position to put a kid in. How you feel about it matters to me. You're important to me. It leaves the kid feeling safe. It leaves the kid feeling taken care of. It lets the kid trust the parent that much more. And it says that they count. And basically, that's all of us want in life. They know that dad's got to have a job or mom's got to have a job, whoever the breadwinner is. They know that. But they're not going to understand all of the intricacies of that until they become an adult. But as a kid, they certainly know how they feel if they're not given a voice.
See, there's something very fundamental about what you're saying, Jim, which is it leads the other person when they believe they have a voice, input. That's with a couple, that's with parents and kids. It's through all the systems together is the desire to at least have a voice and be heard, and that increases trust.
That's right, and that's where you're hinting at the integration piece of integrity. That's exactly what that is. And then going back into the notion of what's powerful or overpowering, yelling at the kids or yelling at your partner, interrupting, accusing, being right, hitting, throwing things, those are all overpowering behavior. Those are behaviors that say to the other, you don't have any power. I don't care what you think. I don't care what you feel. And I don't care what you do. And obviously, that's going to go very counter to building trust in a relationship. And it's going to be putting the overpowering person's integrity at stake all the way along the way. And that's as opposed to powerful behavior, which is listening, accepting responsibility for what you think, what you feel, and what you do, and being willing to talk about it openly and honestly. Now, that's powerful stuff, and that goes directly to integrity. The people who can do that, who can listen to where a kid's made a mistake or where a partner has made a mistake and say, wow, gee, tell me about it. How'd that happen? Rather than basically undressing somebody and dismissing them or diminishing them or putting them down, all that overpowering stuff, the powerful thing to do is to say, you know what? Yeah, I may not like what you did, but I'd certainly like to know a little bit more about it. What happened? Let's talk.
Wow.
Those are very, very integrity-reinforcing, trust-reinforcing, safety-reinforcing behaviors. Now, just to make that practical, what's that actually sound like? Well, here's an overpowering statement I heard somebody say in my office last week. You're a lousy drunk, and if you get drunk at a party again, I'll knock your lights out. Very, very overpowering kind of statement. And he said this to his wife, and I said to her, I said, I'm going to translate what your husband said a different way. And I look at him and say, I want you to listen to me real carefully now, because this is going to sound a little different than what you said. So I role played for him. I said, I'm going to be your alter ego, and here's what you're telling your wife. When you got drunk at the party last night, I felt humiliated. I may not be able to stay in this relationship if that happens a whole lot more. And they just sat there silent. And, of course, she burst into tears, and she said, nobody in my life has ever talked to me that way until this moment. Now, that lets you know what her IQ integrity quotient was going into that marriage. His overpowering statement lets you know where his integrity quotient was going into that marriage. Interesting, isn't it?
Well, what you talk about integrity often involves transparency about oneself. And what you did magnificently in that scenario was have the guy express his pain and his fear.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that makes so much difference. Integrity is about self-revealing, and that's not easy to do.
Well, and he said to me, he said, you know, I don't really know how to talk that way. He said, frankly, that sounds like the way women talk. And I said, well, I know you're right. We could talk a lot about that. But I said, if you boil it all down, what you're really saying is, you were raised in a culture that told you not to feel. And if you did feel, don't express it. You're afraid to tell your wife you felt humiliated because you don't think men ought to feel that way, particularly by their wife's behavior. But you, in fact, felt that way. He said, I did indeed.
Wow.
It's a really, really interesting thing. If we can learn to talk about ourselves, and I maintain that has to start when we're kids. If it doesn't start when we're kids, then our next available opportunity, of course, is when we're in courtship. And it's, you know, there are many reasons why it's very hard to talk about oneself and to talk with integrity or live with integrity in a relationship early on. in courtship because we're trying to win the partner over. We're trying to make him or her ours, so to speak. We're trying to connect in ways that we're very excited about. So conflict management elements come into place by the time we get to courtship, and they've already been developed. All we're going to do now, let's assume this, our IQ, our integrity quotient, number one, and our conflict management skills or abilities are already going to be in place for the most part when we get to courtship. Courtship now is going to reinforce them or not, and that's where things are going to get a little dicey. Because there, the conflict elements are in place, our integrity quotient's in place, our degree of conflict aversion is in place, the degree to which we're differentiated is in place, and by differentiation, for the purposes of this talk, what I mean by that is recognizing that I'm different from the person that I'm having a relationship with. I know where I leave off and they begin. I know what's my stuff and what's not my stuff. It also means being able to manage myself when I'm under stress in such a way that I hang on to my integrity. What that means is if I'm in conflict with my potential partner while I'm in courtship, I can say, hey, you know what? I didn't like it when you did X in situation Y. Let me tell you my Z. Or we won't do that. It depends on our degree of our integrity quotient will determine whether or not we will do that.
It sounds like that takes a lot of practice to get to that place where you can begin to express that to another partner in a courtship situation, that it really takes a lot of prior practice. You don't develop that skill overnight.
I don't think you do, Pete. I think that's absolutely right. And unfortunately, I think we could have a lot more practice at it if we could do it at home.
I think that's when you talked about early life experiences in our family sets the stage for it. I think you're right. That's when it begins.
Yeah. It's interesting. I try to monitor that a little bit with my own kids since they're young adults now, and because I do what I do for a living, I think they're a little bit hesitant to talk to me anyway. But just the same, they're also hesitant to talk about stuff because, you know, they want to be independent and off on their own and managing things for themselves. But by and large, when push comes to shove, if they want to confront us or we want to confront them, we do it. But I'll tell you, it's scary. And I think that it's scary enough to make people want to move away from it. So by the time we get to courtship, you know, we're dealing with our integrity, we're dealing with differentiation, we're dealing with our ability to negotiate, we're dealing with reactivity versus responsivity. And I differentiate between the two by saying that a reaction is behavior without thinking, and a response is behavior that follows thinking. Those are very, very difficult things to maintain in a courtship, but they're very, very important. Conflict management elements that are going to come into play, obviously, will be the degree of conflict aversion that we arrive with, our ability to negotiate. And, you know, negotiation is a very, very tricky deal. Most of us, because we came from hierarchical situations, we learn the hierarchical form of negotiation, which is trying to get the best deal. And as I learned from you through our years together in terms of negotiating, it takes a lot of integrity, and it builds integrity and reinforces integrity to do the couple version of negotiation, which is to make a suggestion for a situation that includes what might work for your partner as well as yourself. And when you do that, you're coming from a place of integrity. You're saying, hey, you know what? I care about you, and here's my solution, and I think it might work for you in this way, and here's how it'll work for me. What do you think? Very, very
powerful. That's the integration you're talking about, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. the degree of conflict aversion or the fear of conflict, if you're afraid of conflict, you're not going to confront it when you want to, and so that's going to have an impact on your courtship. If you're afraid of conflict, you're going to do a lot of going along to get along when you'd rather not, and that means you're going to lie. Because if I don't want to do something, then I'm truly selling myself out versus being a good sport, then I'm going to lie instead of speaking the unpopular. And conflict aversion automatically puts your integrity at stake because you have to lie in order to reduce the anxiety that comes with telling the truth. That's why if we can get our kids to tell the truth much earlier in life, they're going to have it a lot easier later in life when they run into somebody who they really care about. Because then they're going to say, you know what, I care about this person enough to tell them the truth, rather than I'm afraid of losing this person so much, I better lie. So if you cannot tell the truth, integrity and trust are automatically compromised. It's just that simple. And if they're automatically compromised, well, then the trust that's a fundamental element in any relationship is going to be lost. And I got to tell you, I believe that trust is a fundamental thing that determines how close two people in a committed relationship are going to feel and be. And you're not going to get the trust without the integrity. So basically, you take your IQ, your integrity quotient, you match it up with your TQ, that's your trust quotient. We haven't talked a lot about that, but the same principles apply. You grow up with integrity and trust are so integrally linked that we leave home with a certain degree of our ability to trust as well, and that's what I call the trust quotient. And those two things lead to closeness and intimacy. But now here's the rub. The problem is folks frequently fall in love prior to testing a potential partner for integrity and trust. Now, what I'm implying here is that love doesn't necessarily have anything to do with integrity or trust. All right? And that's hard, I think, for some people to accept. They feel
so... Yeah,
that's
a crucial point. Right on.
Yeah, I think that... you feel so good about who you're with that you don't even think about integrity. You don't even think about trust unless you're conscious of that stuff to begin with. And then if you are, then you make a lot of inquiries. You make a lot of comments about that stuff with your potential partner, so that you can actually end up with somebody that you can trust and build a life with. There's a reason the divorce rate is so high, and it's a complex issue, so I'm not about to say I have the answer to that. But I will tell you that obviously not being able to match up integrity and trust has an awful lot to do with it. Now, you might ask, why does falling in love occur prior to determining your respective partner's IQ and TQ? Well, one word. It's a varying degrees of desperation. What is desperation? Well, it comes in a lot of hidden forms. One is the inability to be alone. Another one is your desire for acceptance overrides suitability of a potential partner. Let me say that again. The desire for acceptance, that is one's desire to be accepted, overrides the suitability of the potential partner. And the way that looks is, well, all right, I'm dating him or her. At least I got somebody, finally. I'm not alone. I've been so worried about being alone. I've been so worried nobody would want me. I don't care what they're like. Now, of course, that's all unconscious. But that desire, that fear of being alone, overrides the suitability of a potential partner. And the third thing that comes with this desperation is the inability to measure one's self-acceptance without outside validation. And that ties directly in with differentiation, which is a talk for another day. But basically, I can't feel good about myself unless I have you in my life telling me I'm okay. That's a factor of desperation, and that's what people mean by, quote, falling in love. And that automatically goes right to the notion of compromise and selling oneself out and a lack of integrity. Let's see. Some of the typical areas where in courtship where integrity typically is compromised. Well, it happens when we have talks about sex, money, or our family or our potential in-laws. Imagine having frank talks about sexuality instead of hormonal reactions to the possibility of sexuality. The inability to talk about those three main areas because of the degree of conflict aversion, the degree of anxiety, and so on and so forth, will compromise integrity. And that's an extremely important piece of courtship, is to be able to talk about it. Now, I want to talk about one last thing. I see we're getting a little short on time here. I want to talk about the limits of integrity quotient and trust quotient. First of all, it's one thing to say that we can be honest. But it's another thing to say, well, what if I can't tolerate? What if I'm a 75 on the integrity quotient scale, but my potential partner's a 90? What's going to happen? That person may demand of me a higher degree of integrity than I'm willing or able to provide. Then what am I going to do? And I think that that's a really, really tough question. And I see it happening a lot. And often people don't realize that's what's going on until they get into the couples counseling room and they start to talk about it. It's a very, very important issue for couples to think about. It's, you know, and I'll give you an example. One couple not too long ago was telling me he wanted to talk about what would happen if there was an infidelity in the marriage. And she was not able to do that. She said, well, there's not going to be an infidelity in the marriage. He said, well, we don't know if there will be or not. We're not married. And infidelity basically only happens to married people or committed people. so we probably ought to talk about that. And she said, well, all right, let's talk about it. What would you like? What's your biggest concern? He said, well, my concern is how to keep us faithful. She said, what do you suggest? Great question. He says, well, what if I came to you one day and said, honey, you know, I've been thinking about having sex with other people. Got nobody in mind in particular, but I'm not too happy about our sex life right now. And I think it'd be kind of nice to, you know, hop the fence. And she absolutely went apoplectic and said, oh, my gosh, now that degree of honesty I can't take. What I can take is you telling me, you know, I'm not too happy with our sex life. Can we talk about it? That I can tolerate, but I couldn't tolerate the other one. And he said, well, we have a problem because I've been telling you that now for 6 months, and you're not responding. And I thought, wow, what a moment of truth, right?
Yeah, no kidding.
Eric, you were going to say something, Pete?
Nope, I said that's one of those wow moments.
Yep, and I mean, it really made it clear what the differences were between the degree of honesty they could each tolerate. And I'm not sure where that's going to go, but my guess is it's going to have a hard time going forward because I don't think he will permit it for himself. So, you know, imagine the conversation, between a committed couple after one of them makes that kind of statement. If it can be tolerated, if it can help bump her up to the next level, great. Then they've got something going on. But what he did that I appreciated a lot is that he put himself in a position of vulnerability. He said something to her that was pretty unpopular, risking rejection.
No kidding.
And see, I think vulnerability is one of the things that triggers people's do-or-die moment of whether or not they're going to show up with integrity. You know, vulnerability is many things, but more than anything, it's the experience of risking rejection. And for some people, it's also the risking the possibility of acceptance. Some people have a hard time being accepted. So you tell the truth. The clashes with values, desires, feelings. In general, you risk rejection when you say the unpopular thing. But if you're really looking to see if you've got a partner who can deal with you at your level of integrity, then you have to do it. Otherwise, you risk running into some pretty substantial conflict later on.
So, Jim, we just have like 1 or 2 minutes left.
Yep.
Is there any last point that you want to make as we just are winding down here for today?
I don't think there's any point I'd like to make, although I would like to say to people that to think about their wedding vows. There's a good jumping off point if they want to think about their relationship now, whether they've had an actual wedding or a commitment ceremony, to think about their vows and to think about how specific and detailed they were versus general. And in there, they'll get a good sense of their integrity quotient.
Wow.
You know, what does it mean when we say we say I take so and so to be my lifelong committed partner? Well, what is a committed partner? What does that mean? Let's define that. To have, what does that mean? To hold, what does that mean? Sickness, in sickness and in health, what do those mean? You know, I'm thinking about people taking a chance to look at something they've already committed to and look at how specific they were. And see how that connects with their level of integrity. That's really the only other thing I have left to say. I mean, there's a lot more here we could talk about, but I think it's really important to be able to look at, for couples to find a way, with or without facilitation, to kind of get an idea on what's my own IQ versus my partner's. Let's see if we can talk about those together and, you know, look at what we have here, particularly for having a lot of conflict. If we're not in a lot of conflict and things are going along, there's a pretty good chance we're probably operating at pretty high mutual reciprocal IQs. But if not, there may be a problem there. And I say that's the place to go look.
Well, I really appreciate that advice. Good, good, good advice. And the thing I really appreciate today, Jim, about what you've done is to take a topic like integrity and talk about it in a way that doesn't sound like you're coming from the pulpit on Sunday morning.
Yeah, in fact, if people decide what their IQ is, what you can do is ask yourself, what's my degree of conflict aversion? Give it a number. What's my ability to tolerate anxiety? Give that a number. What's my history of omissive lying? Give that a number. What's my history of commissive lying? Give that a number. And what's my ability to tolerate the other's honesty? Give that a number. Add it up. See what your numbers are. They're not going to find a science here with it, but you're going to give yourself another way to think about it.
And that's what I really, really appreciate what you've done for us today, Jim. I really respect, appreciate your insights, how you put them together, and how you can talk about these things both personally and professionally, and the recognition of what a challenge it is, because it's not a simple thing to do, is to stay in integrity. So I really appreciate what you have offered and given us today, and frankly, I'm just glad that you're my colleague and friend.
Well, thank you very much, Pete. Yeah. It's been a lot of fun. I really enjoy this. I hope I can do it again, and I hope that the listeners, you know, can glean something from this for themselves, and we'll be in touch in the future, I'm sure, very soon, and I wish you well.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, and we will send out, Ellen and I will send out soon an announcement for our next call and our next topic, and until then, be well, and we'll see you then. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Thanks,
and goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.